Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Welcome to another episode of Mind Shift Podcast. I've got a fantastic conversation coming up in just a few minutes with atheist Bethany Carter. This is really cool because Bethany and I have been friends on Twitter for a long time now, and she has been a part of our Mind Shift Podcast Facebook group for a long time as well, and it's really cool getting to know her. And it's kind of funny because Neil and I were talking on Twitter back and forth about how the episode was so good, and we gotten a lot of really positive feedback from people that had listened to our chat. And Bethany said, hey, I want someone to hear my story. So actually, as it turned out, I said, well, you can be on my podcast. Let's get together. Let's chat. So we did. And also Neil is going to have her on his YouTube channel. So that's pretty cool. Now, this is an amazing story. I'm not going to spoil the whole thing, but what's amazing about it, I think, this whole issue of how spanking, really, as Bethany will tell her story, spanking, this issue of how to discipline her kids, started her pulling on a thread, if you will, a thread of deconstruction that led to this unraveling of her whole faith, her former Christian faith, and I'm going to let her tell her story. But you know, it's amazing when you step back. If you're like me, you've come out of evangelical fundamentalist Christianity. There's a lot of things to unpack about our childhood if you were raised in the church, or perhaps it was very cult-like, as many people have told me on Twitter. My church was a full-on cult, basically. And in many ways, what I've been studying in this area of connecting evangelicalism, certainly fundamentalist Christianity, with the world of the cults, is that there's a tremendous amount of psychological damage and trauma, things like rapture anxiety. This is something that Beth and I are going to touch on in a little bit. This whole issue of, for example, people like me who were absolutely terrified as young children being forced to watch those horrible apocalyptic end times movies, A Thief in the Night, A Distant Thunder, and some of the other ones. There were actually four films in this series. Absolutely terrified me. In fact, I sat down after talking to Bethany and I was thinking about my story. I sat down and I wrote an example of what happened to me when I was about 12 years old. I'll put the link in the show notes if you want to read it. It's an article that's sitting on Medium, on my blog on Medium. But I talk about something that happened to me as a result of this trauma around this movie, A Thief in the Night, how I was always terrified that I was going to be left behind in the rapture. And now that I've not only walked away from the church, I've walked away from Christianity full stop, I have to go back and I have to unpick those, you know, kind of threads as Bethany did around this issue of how to discipline her children. And, you know, it led to all kinds of other things. And basically that's sort of what happened to me when I started studying the world of the cults. One thing led to the next and to the next and to the next. And it's opened up all kinds of amazing things, like meeting people like Bethany and so many others. And in fact, coming up, hopefully by the time this episode or the next episode drops in a couple of weeks, I'm going to have a recording with Dr. Janya Lalich. We've been kind of playing tag. And in fact, as I'm doing this podcast, this introduction right now, we were actually supposed to be doing our recording tonight, but she's unfortunately ill, so we're going to have to reschedule. But that's coming up pretty soon. I've also got the guys from the How To Heretics. We kind of missed our recording date. I screwed up and I forgot to put it in my phone. So I had those guys on the hook and I blew it, basically. So I've got to reschedule with them. I'm also going to be talking with Chris Shelton. I'm going to be on his podcast, his show coming up. And in fact, when this episode drops this Friday, he and I are going to be talking and he's going to be interviewing me about my time in evangelicalism, the trauma that was associated around that, and how, like I say, I've been sort of correlating those things with the world of the cults and how that results in a lot of religious trauma and having to unpack and unpick a lot of conditioning and a lot of issues. And hopefully you'll get some help. That's what I'm here to help you do. If that's your background or if you've come out of the cults, that's what I'm here to help you do. Now, I just want to say a couple of quick thank yous before we get into the chat with Bethany. I want to give a big thank you to Rebecca Mon, as well as to the guest I had on a couple weeks ago, Ronna Russell. Both of them have just recently become new Patreon supporters of this show. And of course, Ronna was already in our Closed Mind Shift group, but it's good to have Rebecca in there as well to get to know her a little bit. And that's a really cool benefit to being a Patreon supporter of the show. Not only do you get early access to episodes every Wednesday, but you get to be a part of our closed group, which is growing all the time. We've got some absolutely fantastic people. In fact, we've had some really good discussions around some issues that have come up here, there, and everywhere in our real life experiences. And it's a good place to kind of throw things out there and say, hey, guys, I'm working through this. What do you guys think? And it's really helpful to bounce it off of other people and hear their different perspectives. And in fact, just the other week, I was going through some stuff online and I reached out to David Hayward, the Naked Pastor, who's been on the show. And I said, hey, man, I really need to talk to you. And he was right there. In fact, we've chatted a couple times. We've Skyped a couple times. And he's helped me work through some stuff. And again, I'm just bouncing things off of him and saying, am I crazy? Is this how I'm seeing this? Is this what's going on here? And he's been super helpful, giving me some interesting points of view, perspectives. So it's just fantastic to have resources like that, people who've been there, who've done that, who've come out of that background, but yet have that sort of wisdom, the experience of years, and some hard stuff that we've all worked through and are continuing to work through. So if you're interested in being a part of a supportive community, then you can be a supporter. For example, you could support the show just for like a per episode donation. And those kind of things help me meet my monthly expenses, things like podcast hosting, website hosting, all the basic expenses that are associated with bringing you this show twice a month. So I would definitely appreciate it. I know the other people in the group would love to meet you. So thanks again to Rebecca as well as Ronna. All right, so let's go on into it. I'm interested now to hear what you think as we listen in to Bethany's story and her continuing journey, really, of where she's going in her life in this journey of not just deconstruction, also of reconstruction as well. So I'm interested to hear what you think of Bethany's story. So let's go on into how spanking my children made me an atheist with this week's guest, Bethany Carter. Glad to be joined by Bethany Carter, coming out of, well, near Nashville, or is it Nashville? Nashville? I don't know. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. How do you pronounce Nashville or Nashville?
I would say Nashville.
Nashville. So you're pretty much a native, so we're going to go with Nashville, Tennessee. I'm glad we connected. You were mentioning on Twitter not long ago that you wanted to talk about your story. So here we are. We're interested to hear what your kind of background is, because we were saying a little bit before we hit the record button that both you and I were born into sort of an evangelical fundamentalist Christian background and have since come out of that. This issue of reclaiming one's identity is a big one, isn't it? Because for people like you and me, we never really had a pre-religious identity. We just kind of were born into it. We accepted what they said as true. And now we're kind of going, wait a minute, who am I? What's the person that I am? So I'm really interested to hear where you grew up and your sort of backstory in religion.
Okay, so I live here an hour and a half south of Nashville in what you would say the nursery capital of the world in McMinnville. I was raised about 30 minutes from here in a little small town, and my parents were strict fundamentalists, Southern Baptists. My dad was going to be a preacher, but he, you know, decided that it wasn't profitable to be a preacher. Corporal punishment, no Harry Potter, that type of parenting. My mom hated astrology, Scooby-Doo, anything that had like any type of hints of witchcraft, any kind of supernatural type of things. I really didn't start exploring my identity probably till I had my first child. I fell hard and fast, you know, for the faith at 11, you know, saying the sinner's prayer and getting involved in our youth group and our church. And, you know, God felt real to me. But at the time, my parents and I, we didn't get along, and I didn't really feel compelled to believe anymore. So I kind of left my faith dormant. I wasn't really interested in it. It didn't identify with me. So, you know, to keep my parents happy, I was pretty happy as I grew up, 18, 19, 20, to have that label of spiritual, but not religious. And when I had my first child in 2015, I had a really good relationship with my mom and dad. And it wasn't until we had a falling out about, you know, we had a family crisis that happened with my first child, I needed some babysitting, and I was sent, you know, into all sorts of confusion and just grief. And I needed to go get some help, some therapy to try to help deal with my situation. And on where this all ties into, as far as my faith goes, I didn't walk into a Christian counselor and expect to come out an atheist. And in therapy, you know, you learn about your techniques and you learn about your feelings and you learn about how you identify with the world. And there was a lot of, for about 3 years or so, some words like codependency and toxic relationships. And once I figured out and navigated myself through my codependency issues with my parents and other relationships and how I view the world, I finally figured out that why can I not shake this last bit of codependency? And I wasn't really sure why, until my husband and I were having trouble agreeing on discipline methods for my 2, 2.5 year old. And that was causing a great sense of conflict. And my therapist was encouraging us to come to some sort of terms on this. And I had already thought, my husband and I had made up our minds about, you know, we're not going to spank, we're not going to do this. And my husband was pushing spanking, and which turned out I was pushing back against the Christian counselor, and he was getting a little pushy about parenting methods, and head of the household type topics were brought into therapy. So I turned to YouTube and some other scholarly journals about parenting, which led me into secular type parenting type ways of thinking. And I landed on a podcast about how to discipline your child, about like corporal punishment and like from an atheist perspective. And I finally, after kind of going into rabbit holes on YouTube, you know, like where that algorithm just keeps going and going, I started to realize, I found videos about the satanic panic, and I realized, oh my goodness, this stuff that my mom wouldn't let me watch was kind of tied to that 1980s, early 90s satanic panic. And I started to realize, be honest with myself, you know what, I don't think I believe in this stuff anymore. And it wasn't until I came to that conclusion or realization of that label, it was frightening. It was, my therapist did not respond well to it. My Christian counselor, I mean, he freaked out, and he was upset. My husband was distraught, to say the least.
That you'd left the faith?
Yes.
That was certainly not the counselor's aim by any stretch. Was he trying to talk you back into the faith and back into the church at all?
A little bit. He even told my husband at one point, oh, she'll come back. She'll come around. Yeah, she's been hurt. So that's why she is this way. This is why she's angry at God. And
it's just a phase. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Once you see sense, you'll be back in the fold.
Yeah.
But you realize that there's a lot of religious trauma, a lot of issues around, certainly as you mentioned, this thing of spanking, because I was raised in a very fundamentalist home as well, like you, and both of my parents subscribed to the Bill Gothard treatment. You know, we were in that Bill Gothard cult. Well, that's my parents tried to raise us according to his principles, which was spare the rod, spoil the child. I've talked about this before, where, you know, the idea is that you spank a child to break his or her proclivity to sin. And so this is all somehow mandated in the Bible, and God is behind it, and he's set up this authority structure with the father and then the mother underneath that, and then the children underneath the mother. I mean, it's a very authoritarian, patriarchal system that produces a tremendous amount of physical and emotional and spiritual trauma. So you didn't want to duplicate that with your own son. So this is a very interesting path that you kind of have been walking along, this thing of, it all kind of started with spanking in a way, didn't it?
Yeah, because I really started to question my faith and who God was after reading studies. And at first, you know, I had that cognitive dissonance about reading those spanking studies. You're like, oh, no, I turned out just fine. It's
yeah,
okay.
There's nothing wrong with me.
No, there's nothing wrong with me.
Yeah, nothing
I'm
wrong
not
with me. Yeah, I'm absolutely fine.
And I'm like, well, how is it that all these psychological things are happening? This is a peer-reviewed study, and they've had several studies about child development. I'm like, that's interesting. These organizations, like American Academy of Pediatrics and some other major ones, they don't recommend it because of the psychological damage that is possible with spanking, the anger, anxiety, just the emotional humiliation of it all. And
it's hugely traumatic.
And
I can remember getting many spankings as a kid. I can remember sitting in my room because we were always told we had to wait because my parents had to calm down first. That was what Gothard taught, that you shouldn't spank your child when you're angry. So we'd have to sit in our rooms while my mom or dad calmed down. And we'd sitting there dreading, and the anxiety just built and built and built. And then my sister would go in first, and I could hear her getting spanked. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm next. You know, I could hear the cries and the screams. And then it was my turn. You know, so, yeah, it's hugely traumatic, not to mention the physical pain of the whole thing. And then you tie the God piece into it. They're telling us that they had to do it because it's in the Bible, and that's the way God set it up. So, yeah, there's so many pieces around this issue of spanking and spirituality and religion.
Yeah, and I thought about God, you know, the omnipotent, the omniscient part of God. And I thought, if all these studies are coming out and there's psychological damaging type effects for children and they're traumatized by it, how is it that God can be real or true or available? Why wasn't he there for me or for some other kids who have to go through this? Like, if he knew down the road that people are going to discover this, how is it that spanking is a real thing or it's in the Bible? Like, I started questioning the Bible. Like, why would you recommend spanking if this was going to be discovered?
That's a good point, because going back to my childhood, the way it was explained in the Bill Gothard seminar was that, okay, God is the creator of humanity. So obviously he knows our psychology, our mental processes, and what's good for us mentally, physically, and everything else. And this is the way he has set up the family structure. And spanking is a big part of that, because that is what children need. That's an actual requirement. Because if you let the child go, you know, sideways, and you don't spank them and correct their behavior, then they'll go off into witchcraft and sin, you know, rebellion, which is as the sin of witchcraft. And so that's a good point. If God is our creator and he knows human psychology, obviously better than anyone, why would he prescribe such a system? That's obviously so traumatic and so damaging. There's the cognitive dissonance, isn't it? That so many Christians must be sitting in there going, this is God's plan. I'll just beat my kids without any sense of how traumatic it is for them.
Well, like, I started finding out about what James Dobson had to say about it.
There's another one.
Pearl books, Michael and Debbie Pearl, how they prescribed, like, I think they called it blanket training, where you put an infant on a child, like when they're just starting to learn to crawl, you can put them on a blanket and you teach them to stay on that blanket by smacking the side of their legs with this object, whatever instrument that they prescribed in this book. And I was horrified between that and James Dobson's cry it out type of recommendation.
Yeah, I remember that. Same thing.
Like, it was traumatic for me. And I thought I could never do that to my child. It was just, there was too much of an emotional, maybe it was emotional type of feelings why I couldn't do what I should have done, but I never thought it was right. I didn't think it was right. So when I started pushing back in therapy about spanking, that kind of made me look into way more stuff. And like I said, I started diving into all these rabbit holes. And when I was having conversations with my husband about it, it was those lines of, well, it's not really beating. It's not harmful. And we turned out,
it's not abuse.
It's not abuse.
Yeah.
The therapist clearly said that you're not beating them. You're just spanking them. Or you need to have this wooden spoon or whatever to remind them. Oh, I never had to spank my kids, but I had this spoon where they could see it.
Just a threat alone.
Yeah, they learned not to cross me, and I still didn't feel right about that. It was weird. I don't understand, like, how the spanking kind of quite opened my eyes to God and to start really questioning who I was, but it kind of forced me to be a little bit more honest and want to do that more reason-based scientific approach. That's when I started discovering that I was an atheist. And when I told my husband, he was very upset. And we've never been to church, maybe only a few times the whole time we've been married. And we're not real religious here at my household. So my husband was shocked, to say the least, and because he thought our marriage vows would be called into question. You know, I thought we were saying our marriage vows in front of God and in front of everybody, and I had to set him straight and say, look, I was making these promises to you if God was there, cool. But I really wasn't, I wasn't making those promises to you, you know, to God at the same time. That was just me.
Yeah, and that was a different person then, too.
Mm-hmm.
You were saying those words, but does that mean you're supposed to knuckle under, according to the James Dobson sort of husband and wife relationship? That's the scenario, isn't it? That, and again, though, I could see where you could deconstruct your view of the Bible and therefore God, because it's pretty clear in the New Testament that that's the model. The wife is to submit to her husband as to Christ. That's what it says in Ephesians 5. And that's obviously, that verse has been used and abused, but it's in the text. It's right there.
Yeah.
Paul said it. And it's a bludgeon to make wives and women in general submit, not just married women. I've heard it said many times in churches that if you're a woman, you need to be under the authority of a male leader, a pastor. A lot of churches even now won't allow female elders or pastors at all. And that's right from the pages of the Bible. I can remember when I was an elder and a pastor having these same discussions with people, because I would have women preach. I had a woman in our church about every 6 weeks. We had a rota, like a rotation of preachers, and she was one of our preaching team. And it caused such a hassle every time she preached. And she wasn't in any sort of leadership. She was just a gifted speaker and was really good at it. And man, you should have heard the pushback. Women are not allowed to teach men. Women, it's in the Bible. You know,
yeah.
So there you go. Back again to the patriarchy, the misogyny. And it's, the Bible is inerrant and it's inspired by God. So it comes from God, and that's what it says. So what kind of a God is putting that stuff on, in a sense, on paper through human authors, though? You know, there's a problem there. You're going to end up with, at tracing it back to God somehow and having a problem with that God. I think that's where I'm at anyway. I've got a lot of problems with the God of the Bible for those kinds of reasons that you're talking about.
Yeah, and for me, and it's probably with a lot of folks too, like, and I saw this on a documentary too, and I was watching about Bart and Tony Campolo. He had like an image of like a Jenga tower. Mine was like a Jenga tower. You take a block out, it kind of stands. You take another block out, it's still standing. And eventually you pull the block at the right place and it all falls down. And when I was raising these concerns to my therapist, I'm like, I don't believe anymore. This is who I am now. And I'm starting to finally get a handle on my codependency and understanding like where it was all stemming from. Like I couldn't get to the root of it until I kind of just realized that this is where I was at spiritually. And he, of course, didn't respond well to it. I had my husband who wasn't responding well to it. And I had just had my second child, and he was about 3 to 4 months old, 4 months old or so. So I am constant dread of the next therapist appointment. And my husband's going separately to the same therapist I was if I wasn't going that week because I was at home with my child. He would come home and he'd be like, hey, we need to get on the same page. This is what our therapist was saying. You know, I'm supposed to be the head of the household. You know, y'all need to have a discussion. You know, she needs to realize, kind of, and I'm being a little bit more harsh on my language here, but she needs to kind of get in line and realize.
Yeah, toe the line.
I'm
in charge around here.
I'm in charge. I'm in charge. You know, you can have your opinion, but you know what really?
Yeah, I have the final say. That's a biblical concept as well, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The concept of male headship in the home. The man is ultimately, and that's how I've always heard it explained. And I probably taught sermons on this too. I hate to say it, but I did when I was a pastor. And the caveat always was that we always told the men, we said, now listen, yes, you are the final say. The wife has her opinion and you better listen to her. But the issue is that when you make those final decisions, you are then accountable to God. See, mm-hmm. So you have to be careful when you put your foot down and say, no, this is the way it's going to be. We always kind of try to qualify it and say, you better take it seriously. You better listen to your wife. But ultimately, it still came out that the man was the head of the house. So you're fighting this patriarchal system and not, that doesn't sound like you're getting very far.
No.
How did it work out then in the end? Did you stay together or how did it work out?
Yeah, like I was starting to feel, you know, this massive sense of like of anxiety that I felt like I had a cement block on my chest. I had a postpartum appointment or like a well woman checkup, and I told my gynecologist, I said, look, I've got a lot of things changing right now in my life. My beliefs have changed. I think I'm going to need some sort of postpartum anxiety medication or something, that I'm being treated very strangely in my therapist environment. And it was starting to be really oppressive. And I told her, I was like, I'm thinking about changing therapists. But, you know, what is my chances of getting some sort of anxiety medication? And she encouraged me to change therapists, and then we would see if I would need medication afterwards to kind of deal with the anxiety. And that, you know, it was grief. You're losing your faith. You're losing everything that you knew in your identity. So it was,
yeah, it's huge.
Massive amount of angst and that sense of betrayal. And I didn't feel like I was betraying my husband, but I felt like I was being dishonest in places. But then I wasn't even aware that I was being this dishonest, kind of like this double life mentality. So I had heard on one of my podcasts, the ones that kind of like kind of opened my eyes, they talked about the Recovering from Religion website and then the Secular Therapy Project. So I'd reached out and clicked the links and found the list of the secular counselors, and I ended up meeting up with one, and it was night and day. Within like a couple months, things started to kind of come together just a little bit. And you know, when you first kind of convert to atheism, it's really hard not to be that like angry atheist type. And I was really angry for such a long time, because my parents, I felt lied to, very upset. I couldn't stand how I was being treated in a Christian counselor environment. I felt that he was becoming suddenly very disingenuous. So once I started getting the resources that I needed, I got a little bit more courage, and my therapist urged me to be like, hey, why don't you try to go find one of those Recovering from Religion meetups close to where you are? I mean, it's an hour away, but I did it. I went and drove to this library, and I met an amazing bunch of people, and we talked about what that deconstructive version is. And what's good about the Recovering from Religion meetings is that they don't try to convert you either way. They want to explore the why you believe something and how religious has traumatized or hurt you and affected you. And of course, you know, like you were talking about in one of your podcasts about Christianese, my therapist, when I would bring up stuff about religion, he never helped, because it was always, well, I don't like religion either. It's not a religion. It's a relationship.
It's a relationship. How many times have we heard that one?
And it's like, you're not helping. You're kind of gaslighting me right now. And you're kind of invalidating me, even though I think you're trying to be helped. So little by little in therapy, you know, we'd sit there and we'd talk about this. I would keep going to meetings about once a month. It was once a month for a few months. And then my therapist said, hey, why don't you go find a community of people, and found Sunday Assembly in Nashville. Yeah, it's an hour and a half away from me, but I managed to talk my husband into going with me to the first one. It was in May. So it's been about a year now. And my husband was kind of like, what are we doing? Where are we going?
What's this Sunday now? Am I going to miss football?
Yeah.
As long as we're back by time for the game, I'm all right. Huh?
Yeah. Well, he's not even like the football type.
Okay. It might be a hard sell if he was, I think.
Yeah. He was more like, where are we going? I said, oh, it's a meeting for
just a meeting.
Secular, you know, just real. I had no idea what I was getting into either.
Right.
And then he enjoyed it. We've been going for about a year, and as time has gone on, and learning about stuff like street epistemology, and staying in my secular therapist environment, we finally learned how to talk to each other a little bit more, where they're productive. So every time we're driving up to Sunday Assembly once a month, we're having these conversations that are productive, and we're not at each other's throats as much. Because I wasn't sure my marriage was going to survive it. Because I know some people, when their spouse changes that faith or they leave the faith, I mean, they don't like that. In fact, therapist had told my husband that. He goes, well, my wife had left the faith and told me she didn't believe anymore. He goes, well, you know, we wouldn't be together. That just wouldn't be acceptable.
Wouldn't survive.
Yeah, and I think that can be really crushing. They're in a mess. They're deconstructing, and they're like, okay, so the person that I thought cared about me is going to just leave me in the dark, you know, just shut me out. And it's not helpful.
Not helpful. Well, this is a really good point. I want to go back to that issue of this Christian therapist that you were seeing, because we've said this before. I've talked about this with David Hayward and Janice Selby and a couple other people about recommending that you, if you're deconstructing, not necessarily becoming an atheist, but just questioning things, you should not seek out a specifically Christian counselor. Maybe it's okay if you have a counselor who just happens to be a Christian. I don't know. But we can see in your story, I think this is the clearest example I've heard yet of why you should not seek out a specifically Christian counselor. This guy was, as you say, gaslighting you. He was undermining you, trying to prop up your husband, this patriarchal biblical worldview. And look what, and then as soon as you leave him and get another counselor who's a secular sort of counselor, that anxiety just kind of goes away that you thought you needed medication for. So this is a clear example, isn't it, of why you should not seek out a specifically Christian counselor. And I'm sure there are some who are better than others. I mean, we don't want to paint them all with a broad brush, do we? But this is a good example as to maybe why you should think twice about finding a counselor who might happen to be a Christian.
There's like some red flags and why I knew I probably wasn't in the right place when my therapist, he would get upset because my husband would tell me about their conversations that they would have if I wasn't there. He was alarmed that I was going onto YouTube and finding all these podcasts.
Atheist podcasts.
Yeah, like he was really upset by that. And I couldn't understand why, because we'd had a really good relationship. I'd learned so much about myself. And that's where the Christian counseling was decent. It wasn't all bad. And it just don't change your beliefs midway. Don't change. Because
Or come back to the fold.
Yeah, unless you come back to the fold, it's not going to be productive. And
it's never going to work. Well, if it is a phase you're just going through, well, you know, if you put it in the language of the cults, which is what I've been studying so much, I can't help but start thinking in terms of like how cults operate. You know, this is information control. He's saying you shouldn't expose yourself to certain information. And that's a classic kind of marker of cults, isn't it? Where they don't want you seeing information that's going to make you question your beliefs or question their teaching. So that's a kind of a cultic thing. All this stuff about religious trauma, manipulation, coercion, physical abuse, sexual abuse, and all these things that happen in both cults and churches cause a huge amount of trauma and damage emotionally, psychologically, that we've got to then recover from, which is the ultimate irony. Religion is this thing that was supposed to give us enlightenment and peace and love and forgiveness and wholeness and healing and everything else. And it in turn gave us a bunch of trauma and abuse. It's insane how it all works.
Yeah, and I think just for fun, one day I went to Barnes & Noble and I got the Brick Bible. Have you seen it?
The which Bible?
The Brick Bible.
Brick Bible. No, I've never heard of it.
Okay, it's amazing. So imagine all your favorite Bible stories, but with photographs with Legos acting it all out.
Oh, I see. Like block people.
Yeah, so it's all Legos. Every last one of the stories are, and it has all like the, it's got your sunshine verses, you know, the happy, clappy Jesus. And then you've got the stories about, you know, the wall of Jericho and
the genocide,
flood, the foreskins, the.
Oh, know, how do you do that with a Lego person?
Yes, all the foreskins. And, you know, that's my favorite
horrifying
part. Yeah, and
Lego foreskins. I didn't know that was a thing. Apparently, it's a thing.
It's hysterical. I highly recommend it. It's up in my bookshelf right now because I wanted to show it to my kids someday.
But, probably not when they're two or three. That might be a little traumatizing.
No, yeah.
300 and Philistine foreskins, kids.
Yes, not 100, but 200.
Yeah.
And I remember telling my counselor about it, and he goes, you know, they make that old Christianese too. They're like, oh, well, man's done a lot of horrible things compared to God, and these stories are, they're this way because, you know, insert your favorite apologetic. Oh, it's a fallen world. So, you know, these things had to happen. These
people we've heard
had
them
to
all
be slaughtered, and
it was the culture. Everyone was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sinful, evil people, and they needed to be wiped out.
Yeah.
We've heard, you know, you could, like you say, you could insert, there's so many different apologetics on that issue of genocide and holy war and everything. We've heard them all, if you've been around the church at all.
Yeah, and that's kind of how I grew up, too. You know, you hear these Bible stories, and you think, man, that's really awful that all
pretty
these
horrifying
people died. And I was like, oh, well, because God didn't want so-and-so country to be in a thorn of Israel's side, and I'm thinking, That still doesn't sound right to me, but okay.
But you think about if it happened in today's terminology or in today's historical context, I should say, it would be considered a genocide, a war crime, a crime against humanity. You know, essentially what Hitler was arguing about the Jews, you could say, well, that's kind of the same thing that went on. He was saying, look, we're doing the world a favor by wiping out this vermin. We're wiping out this whole race, and they've been a thorn in the flesh of humanity. Well, all those similar kind of arguments applied, you know, back in the Old Testament. We needed to wipe these people out. It's just the way they, you know, they're a problem, so they had to go. And God mandated it. Again, though, you're back to this problem of who's commanding this stuff. It's God who's telling his people to wipe out men, women, and children, and animals too. Like there's an evil sheep in there too, I guess, and a goat that's horribly evil, so he's got to go too. And
And it was,
that's a big problem.
it was just bizarre. And
It is
I started
bizarre.
finding out about people like Richard Dawkins, and then I kind of accidentally stumbled upon the Atheist Experience and a call-in show. And I remember when I was first still kind of coming to terms with things, I remember hearing Matt Dillahunty taking these phone calls from theists, and I remember feeling angry at first and thinking he's got it wrong. And then once my anger kind of subsided, I thought, wait a minute, what did he just say? He makes a
Maybe he's not
really
so far out,
good
yeah.
point. Like, because it was amazing to me to hear people who were Baptist or whatever faith they were deep in it, they were going to be a preacher. And then the more they read the Bible and the more they thought about things like philosophy, how things would just kind of start to fall apart. And it was kind of mind altering. Like, I'm still sometimes I can't get my head around it, but I can't tell you the importance of when you're going through all this conflict and these feelings, go ahead and feel the feelings and go find community. Even if you can't afford a therapist, go find a local community who kind of shares those belief systems. Because after I stopped talking to my parents 3 years ago almost, finding my Sunday assembly group and the people I've met through recovering from religion it's been the most healing thing for me in the whole wide world. And even my husband for this past year has been questioning his beliefs a lot more. He's not on the I don't believe anymore atheist side of the equation, but he does question. We can have a lot of those type discussions, and he will even listen to the podcast with me. I have a Sunday routine, I'm listening to my call-in shows and just
Yeah,
seeing
you've
if
got your
somebody,
routine. You're not sitting in church.
I see if somebody presents an argument that kind of makes me think about things differently and keep myself open. But so far, I don't know what it would take to bring me back to that other side again because of the problem of evil.
That's a big one too, isn't it? What specifically about that issue really does it for you? What's so problematic?
I think the fact that it goes on and nothing gets done, and then you still have people who go around and say, "Well, it's free will," and I'm like, well, could God create a burrito that's too hot? He can't eat it? Like, to
Yeah.
me,
Could God make a rock so big he can't lift it? All those kind of questions.
It wasn't fair to me to tell my child that, you know what, you're depraved from birth and you deserve hell. It's because of an action that happened all these years ago, and you deserve it. So unless you subscribe to this theology and you accept the quote unquote gift of salvation, then you're just going to burn in hell forever. Like, that to me bothered me. I'm like,
That's a
it
big
makes
problem.
sense. As a Christian, I'm like, well, yeah, that's the way it is, don't you know? And
The
that was
way it
my
is.
for a
We're all
while.
born into sin.
What'd you expect? That's just the way it is. The Bible says. And I realized how circular it was. Well, why do you believe that? Well, because the Bible. Well, what about that? Well, because the Bible. And they don't have
Exactly.
any.
Circular logic.
I
Well, and
think
as I talked about on another podcast, the one about the psychology of conversion. Well, I've suddenly realized that whole problem of being born into sin, how much damage that does to our identity as people when we're told that, you know, it's very damaging to our sense of identity and sense of self that I am a sinner through no fault of my own, apparently. Well, I've also sinned against God too, but it's because I'm sinful by nature. I can't help but sin, you know? So I just that's how come I sin, because I'm a sinner. You see, that's how it works. There's that circular logic again. You know, I'm a sinner because I sin, and I sin because I'm a sinner, and I'm going to hell. But as you say, here comes the reprieve, salvation. But it's actually not good news, because when you get into the church, then you get into this religious system, which just puts you on this mill of good works and accountability groups and a surveilling God who's always watching and he knows every thought. And it's just, it's a very, and so no wonder so many Christians have depression and anxiety and PTSD and on and on and on and on. And they're in this system that produces that kind of trauma.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably in the first year and a half of me seeing a therapist, I had went shopping with my sister-in-law. Now, she's extremely religious. And her and my brother-in-law, they're the types, like, for example, my mother-in-law has OCD. My brother-in-law had the nerve to tell the therapist that they were seeing, which is the same guy that I was seeing. He's just at a different location. Told the therapist to his face that the reason she had a mental illness was because she was being spiritually suppressive.
Oh, okay. Of course. What does that even mean?
Yeah, that's what I asked my husband. I said, what does that even mean? How harmful is that?
And how traumatic.
We were coming home from a shopping trip, and I just listened to my sister-in-law go into some sort of like diatribe about how she's so unworthy and she's so thankful that God could love someone as horrible and a worm like she was. And I was really starting to unpack all my codependency, and I kind of left that part of me behind, that self-esteem, that self-loathing, in the past, because I've worked through it. And I'm just listening to her just go on and on and on in the car about how unworthy she is as a person. And like, no, you're not. You're a great person. You're super smart. You're a speech therapist at a school system. And you probably make a big difference in your kid's life that you interact with in the school system. And you're over here just like dogging yourself. And that's one of those other clues that started to clue me into like, wait a minute, I don't know if religion and God is all cracked up to what it is, because this is harmful. This is harmful theology. But then there are people like my sister-in-law, they just buy it. They're like, it's okay. I suck, but I have Jesus. So it's good.
Jesus saved me.
Yeah.
Well, and so much of the worship music is absolutely just feeds into that same theme that you're talking about. One of the things that kind of triggered me was last year when I was in the States, because my father-in-law was dying of a brain tumor. And so I was over there a lot working and doing things with the family. And I would get in my relative's car, and she always had the radio station tuned to the local Christian radio. And so you'd get in, and all of a sudden, here's this Christian music blasting. You know, it's like, oh my God. And yet I thought, let's just listen to some of the lyrics as I drive around Seattle. And I thought almost every song on this Christian radio station just basically conveys that same sort of theology. I'm so unworthy, but I'm only worthy because Jesus saved me, and I'm a worm and I'm a this. And I thought, my God, even the worship music on the Christian radio is so down on people.
Yeah, like I remember all those times in the youth group going through all those experiences, and we would have those worship songs, and you know, every head bowed, eyes closed, you know, or do you know if you're going to go to heaven tonight, or if you died tonight in a car accident, would you go to heaven? You know,
yep.
If you're not
sure, would God
let
you into heaven?
Raise your hands. And I mean, there was a lot of tearful moments. After I would get into fights with my parents, that not feeling good enough for God, or just feeling like that unworthy, depraved feeling. And it was really, that was traumatic too. Just all those tears and anxieties over, oh man, how do I know if I'm really going to heaven or not?
I better raise my hand. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I was, I've said this before, but I was baptized 3 times because the first 2 times didn't take. And I was so filled with trauma and religious, you know, rapture trauma and all these other things, because I'd seen that movie A Thief in the Night, and I was absolutely terrified I was going to get left behind in the rapture. So I probably prayed the sinner's prayer thousands of times just to make sure that I hadn't lost my salvation and I wasn't going to get left behind, you know. So I raised my hand in those. I rededicated my life to Christ 1,000,000 times, I swear, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm right there with you. But it's so traumatic. That's the point. That is the point, is you're putting especially young children in this environment that is just absolutely placing all this burden on them. And they're not psychologically mature enough and intellectually mature enough to process that. They just accept it as true, and bang, there you have it.
Yeah, like the daycare that my child goes to, and it's a really awesome daycare, but they have their Bible curriculum. They have something like one day a week. It's every week, which isn't real bad, except when I started to pay attention more to what the Bible had to say in all these verses I've been glossed over in my church, because, I mean, we were more New Testament at our First Baptist church than we were Old Testament. Less right. Yahweh,
straight
more
out of the Old Testament. There's a lot of problems in the Old Testament, that's for sure.
Yeah, and they come home with the story. They were talking about the David and Goliath story. And I always heard as a child, you know, even VeggieTales, okay? Oh, it's this awesome tale where, you know, David, the little guy against the big guy, and he defeats him, and it's just a stone and a slingshot. And I thought that was all of it until I don't remember what I was listening to that was atheist related. So I'm slightly obsessed right now.
Right. You're on an atheist kick.
Yeah. Yeah. So at the end of the story, I didn't learn the part in Sunday school where David takes a sword and slices off Goliath's head.
And it's his own sword, wasn't it? Goliath's big sword. That's how the story goes.
Yeah. And I remember thinking, holy shit, no one ever told me that part. And oh my God, they had that story featured one week. And I told my husband, I joked with him. I said, hey, you don't think they tell them the last part of that story, do they? Because my year old come home with like this brown bag with some Bible verse from Samuel that was related on that. And it had fuzzy balls in it. They were like the size of golf balls. Okay. They represent stones.
Oh, I see. Got his five stones.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh shit. I don't think they would say the rest of that story, but okay.
Uh-oh. So did they tell the ending of it, or did they just go into the part where he hit Goliath with the slingshot and that was the end of it?
Yeah, it was just, the glossed over version. And then my husband and I, about 6 months before that, probably, we had a story about Jonah and the whale, because we had a crayon picture that my oldest had brought home. And we thought, had this discussion about free will one night, because we thought, okay, well, Jonah said that he didn't want to do this thing that God wanted to do. It was on the coloring page. It said, Jonah didn't listen to God, and God was trying to get his attention. And, you know, God needed Jonah to be obedient. So he sent this whale after him, you know, to get his attention, to sit there for 3 days. And I thought, well, how's that free will? You know, Jonah already said, hey, I don't want to do this. But yeah,
you have no choice.
Oh, no, I'm following you to the ends of the earth, and I'm going to swallow you up till you, you know, basically sit in time out till you change your tune. And I just thought that was disgusting. It's like, how's that free will?
It is pretty crazy. And yet I remember preaching the book of Jonah, and it was all about the forgiveness piece and how Jonah had a bad attitude. Like you said, and that's what the children's stories, they kind of end the book at chapter 3 when the Ninevites repent. And it's kind of, it's like, hey, yay, it's a good story. Everyone repented, and Jonah, oh wait, forget about chapter 4 where he's sitting out there sulking under the vine. And he's pissed off because they didn't get destroyed, you know. Oh, yeah. Whoops, forgot about that part. He never actually changed his attitude. He only went to Nineveh because he was grabbed by the scruff of the neck and forced to go and tell them to repent, you know. And where's the free will in that? There is none. He had to do it. And he was still sulking even after the sermon was over. It's a crazy story.
I think my deconversion has helped me realized that I needed to be reading more. I started reading a lot more books, and that's becoming a pastime I'd forgotten about. You know, the classic God Is Not Great by Christopher Hitchens was really eye-opening for me. That was a game changer when I was still kind of early in my beliefs and new thought processes. And that was very validating, because it was confusing all the things I'd ever thought and never wanted to say, because I didn't want to offend my family. I didn't want to offend my friends.
And
you know, you're a minority. Yeah.
What's his argument? Is that kind of what we've been saying? Is that if you actually take the God of the Bible to the logical conclusion, you come up with some really horrifying and disturbing, really, conclusions that are pretty, very problematic. If indeed God is the one behind so much of this stuff, so much of the laws I've talked about before, you know, there's a law that if a woman is raped, he has to pay a fine to her family, and then she has to marry him. Can you imagine that? Marrying your rapist after he's just paid a fine to your parents as a young girl. I mean, and that's a law that God prescribed. Where if your teenage children are disrespectful, you drag them out into the city square and everybody stones them to death. And that was prescribed by God. It's pretty awful.
Isn't there one about like rape? If you don't cry out and no one hears you do it. I mean, you can be accused of being an adulteress, and what, they would take you out and stone you.
Yes, in fact, that's one of the ones where the Bill Gothard cult, as an example, they've said that if a woman doesn't cry out if she's being raped, then she has no grounds to accuse her rapist. And that's mm-hmm. a modern day twist on that version, that verse in the Old Testament. And so, you know, it's just a classic thing. Like, it's like the Jehovah's Witnesses with their two witness rule. And that's from the Bible. They've applied it to child abuse, of course, but they say, well, you know, if there's not more than one witness to this child being sexually abused or assaulted, we can't prove it. So it just keeps going on. So,
yeah.
But it's God who gave that law. That's the mm-hmm. whole point. That is the point, you know, and they're just applying it literally. And so pedophiles can get away with child abuse in the Jehovah's Witness organization because of the Bible. So that's a problem.
It's very traumatic, very troubling.
When you kind of
step out of it, you see it.
And that's it. You zoom back away from it. And again, you know what Rick Ross said, it's all about unplugging from the group. If you're not receiving their downloads, like was it your sister-in-law who was babbling mm-hmm. on and on? She's receiving their downloads. She's in the cult bubble, as it were. You know, that's all she knows. And she's just, that's all Christianese. It's all loaded language. It's a thought-stopping technique. That's another classic cult technique where you just start babbling these platitudes because you have that cognitive dissonance, like you say. And so you just retreat into loaded language. And that's a thought-stopping technique. And it's emotional-stopping technique as well. And you just take fortification in this babbling, and it doesn't mean anything. But it stops you from thinking, and that's basically, as I see it, what she's doing.
Yeah.
So again, we're right back into the kind of the cult milieu, the way it works, the psychology of it, I see is very much overlapping with sort of the classic world of the cults, and certainly the religious trauma. Well, now you started writing too. How can people get a hold of your writing? Do you have a blog somewhere?
I have it on WordPress.
Right.
And the moniker is Milk Maiden.
Is there any significance to that? The name of the blog? Or did you just do a random blog name generator?
Well, that was mine, kind of to stick it in the eye of James Dobson. I was breastfeeding at the time, and I'd ran across a story that he had posted and how he was against breastfeeding because he thought it would spoil your infant and that moms didn't need to be that close to your kids, and you didn't. That is kind of tied together with that cried out. And my second child, our breastfeeding hippie crunchy mom vibe went on a lot better than it did for my first kid. So I just come up with the moniker Milk Maiden because I was really proud of myself. And I was proud of the fact that too, that hearing a major evangelical figure was against breastfeeding kind of made it that much more hilarious for me.
Yeah, kind of a middle finger to the James Dobsons of the world.
Yeah.
That's so ironic. But I mean, from his point of view, wouldn't he say that that's how God designed mothers to feed their infant children? I mean, it's so obvious. The kid knows what to do. There's milk there, you know.
Yeah.
What's it for? It's insane. Why do you know? And it's got to be traumatic to a kid who doesn't have that physical contact as well as the nutrition that they're getting from their mom. That's crazy. So that's your blog anyway.
Purity culture is tied to breastfeeding because you notice about how many people they complain about, oh, you just need to cover up. You need to do this and do that. And me
that's
coming from that true love waits and modesty culture and don't tempt a man. I think that all kind of ties together. I think that's why there's that stigma. So I was trying to normalize it more with my second child and just be like, you know what? You know, y'all just going to have to go on. And I think that's the reason why people are stuck in that because of the purity culture and that religious culture that is heavy in everything, all the way down to breastfeeding and child rearing.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there again, we're right back in the world of the cults because the demand for purity is another hallmark of cults. And that's a thing where it's this quest for complete 100% perfection. And so we're demanding it of our kids. Growing up in evangelical churches, they have to sign purity pledges, wear purity rings, pledge purity till their marriage, and it's going to be wonderful. There's going to be fantastic sex, and God's going to bless you amazingly, and the parents are going to get blessed, so it's a win-win. And yet if you transgress, that's where you get into trouble. I mean, my wife growing up in Christian high school, she had an abortion at 17 because largely because of the purity culture around her, that milieu, which was what you just described. She figured, well, now that I'm pregnant, I can't face the people at school. They'll kick me out of school because they'd done that to other girls. So she just went and quietly had an abortion and nobody knew. And that was her solution. And it obviously was hugely traumatic at 17 and having to just deal with this and keep it a secret. So that's the legacy of the purity culture for a 17-year-old girl.
Yeah, it was, you know, I didn't make it through my purity pledge, you know, at 20. You know, I was like, you know, I'm going to go get some birth control. I mean, it was so bad in my house. I mean, I had to hide my birth control at my job because my mom would never have ever let me get birth control.
Oh, yeah. She wouldn't have taken you to get. Yeah. It's a prescription thing, isn't it? You can't just buy it over the counter. So you have to have an adult with you if you're underage anyway.
Yeah. And then like part of the religion, too, like it keeps you from learning what you need to learn. And then, you know, the night before my wedding, the day before, my mom hands me some sort of Christian sex book and hands it to me. And she goes, here you go. I thought you should read this. I'm like, I'm getting married tomorrow.
I don't have time to read this James Dobson book. It wasn't a Dobson book, was it?
It was some like book my parents had picked up. And what's ironic is my parents weren't pure on their wedding day. So my mom tried to like, oh, you need to be pure because we didn't do it.
We didn't make it.
You know, you didn't make it, so maybe
you could.
Yeah, and I'm like, it's a little late for that. And then I just looked at her and I just shoved this book under my bed because I thought you're late to the party. Like
I'm a little bit too late. Plus, yeah, it's the night before your wedding. I think you have other things to do rather than sit around. Oh, guys, I can't do any of this preparation for the wedding right now. I've got to read this book. I don't know what's gonna happen tomorrow night. Now I better go bone up on this reading here. That's crazy. Absolutely crazy. Yeah, a little bit too late. Too little too late, Mom.
Yeah, it stifles you. Like, it stifles my independence for years.
Yeah, and you're always worried about, I mean, as a kid, I was worried that I was going to lose my virginity. And then as time went on, all my friends around me were having sex all over the place. I was then the only one who stood out. And I was a freak. I was the one they laughed at because, like, come on, you're still a virgin at 16 or 17. Come on, man. Yeah. We're all doing it. Everyone's getting laid. And you're the one lone holdout. So, yeah, you feel like you're the alien. You're the outcast. You're the one that's out of step with everyone. But, of course, you're pure. So that's God's blessing you, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, like my mom had rapture anxiety because she was born in 63. So when she was growing up in her little church, she always thought the world was going to end. And she told me how she would remember praying to God and saying, please don't come back before I've had a chance to have sex.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
Hysterical in my mind.
But I've heard a lot of people say that.
It's
just delay it till I get married at least, you know, because of course you can't have sex outside of marriage. So you got to wait till I'm married. And if I'm not old enough, oh my God, you know, I'm only 13 and I got to wait another 6-7 years at least maybe before I can get married and then get have sex. And then if the rapture comes after that, I guess it's all right.
Yeah.
You know, what a convoluted way to think and to live, to have to live like that. It's nuts. But that's religion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think
the pins and needles is awful.
Yeah, yeah. The anxiety, the trauma. Well, and I think too, talking to Neil 604, the atheist from Canada, you know, we were talking about this issue of the damage that religion has done, not just historically, obviously with all the religious wars and everything, terrorism and everything in the name of God, but just the trauma to the individual people. So I'm glad that you're at least, you know, put writing on it, getting stuff out there. That was the other thing I was going to ask you. How can people get a hold of you? What's your best social media platform? Are you active on Twitter or Facebook? Where could people get a hold of you?
My Twitter handle would probably be the best.
So follow you on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle?
Oh.
Now you got to think about it. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
So people can find you if they want to follow you on Twitter. They can also go to your blog and read your posts. I was reading one just before we got started, actually, which was quite fascinating about your journey of how it all kind of started around this area of spanking and then therapy with a Christian therapist. And so there's a really good blog post on that as well. So thanks so much, Bethany. I've absolutely had a great time getting to know you. I know we've been tweeting back and forth forever, but I'm glad to put a kind of a face to the name anyway.
Yeah, I had a blast. Thank you so much for reaching out to me. You're probably one of the coolest, like, laid back Twitter personalities that I found you by accident finding old
Chris
Evangelical
hashtag,
and I just found all these awesome people who are like going through that same type of trauma. It was amazing. I was like, oh, this podcast looks interesting. I'm just getting now into it. So
now I'm getting into it.
Yeah, Seth Andrews, and then your podcast was probably like my two favorites while still trying to navigate everything. So
yeah, I think and having people like you on is super helpful. That's the feedback that I hear from people, from listeners, is that they like just to hear the stories, people's personal stories, and how they've worked through stuff and are continuing to work through it. I mean, we got a long ways to go in this thing, don't we? But we're all on some sort of a journey. If we can help each other, then it's a win-win in my book. So I'm glad to have people like you on the show because it's just one more voice out there, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Bethany. I will be keeping in touch with you even more now on Twitter. Once this episode drops, we'll see what kind of feedback we get.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
You know, the more I think and reflect on it and talk to people like Bethany, I'm coming to believe, I guess you could say, that this is a really troubling issue, the one that we talk about in this podcast today, and that is this issue of the God behind the Bible, as it were. If you think about it, okay, the argument is that the Bible, this is what evangelicals will tell you, the Bible is inspired. That's what it says, 2 Timothy 3:16. All scripture is God-breathed, right? It's inspired. It was inspired. The prophets and apostles spoke or wrote as they were guided by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. This was the common argument. I remember studying this in Bible college and in seminary. Now, here's the issue, though. When you have something in the Bible that's, for example, misogynistic or patriarchal or supports slave ownership or talks about genocide or talks about, you know, any of these issues like problematic laws like Bethany and I were talking about, the problem is you take that to its logical conclusion. You say, now, wait a minute, that human author who wrote those things, they were being guided by the Holy Spirit. And behind that, of course, is God himself. Okay, maybe it's not dictation, and this is the common argument by evangelicals. They'll say, no. When we talk about inspiration, we're not talking about a dictation or ghostwriting model where the human author didn't know what he was writing and then sort of woke up from a trance and, oh, here's the Bible sitting in front of me. I've just written the letter to the Corinthians or the book of Deuteronomy. No, it's a case where the human author's own personality was allowed to shine through. However, the kind of escape clause in that is they'll say, now, wait a minute, though. He was guided by the Holy Spirit such that he wrote exactly what God wanted him to say. And this is where we get into this issue of inerrancy, where the Bible is without error, without mistake. Because, of course, God is ultimately the puppet master, as it were, pulling the strings and making sure through the agency of the Holy Spirit. Because, of course, he's a truth-telling God. He cannot tell a lie. This is how the argument goes. Therefore, every word in Scripture is 100% factually, historically, geographically, etc., etc., true. Now, that's the problem. When you start tracing that back, as we talked about, you end up running into that God. Who's the God who's commanding those sorts of things? Who's the God who's causing his human authors and editors and prophets to say and write those things that are pretty problematic, in fact, very problematic indeed? So you have to start questioning. And I think in the case of Bethany, she started pulling those threads, like I was talking about in the introduction, and the whole thing started to unravel. Or in her analogy, it was the Tower of Jenga blocks. You pull out one Jenga block too many, and the whole thing comes crashing down. As I've been fond of saying many times, it's the House of Cards analogy, isn't it? Your whole faith is based on like a house of cards, and it's too emotionally threatening to consider that you might be not necessarily wrong, but misinformed. Someone may have led you astray or indoctrinated you back into this issue of the world of the cults, psychologically manipulated, coerced you. Who knows? And that's the way that it really often works, not just in Christianity, but in many other cults and religions around the world. And when you step away, you psychologically unplug from the group, you physically unplug and walk away from the group, as we talked about, you're no longer receiving their downloads. You can begin to think critically. You can begin to think clearly, perhaps for the first time in your life, and you can start to unpick the conditioning and work through some of the issues, the grief, the loss, the anger, the betrayal, the loss of the social networks. In the case of Bethany, you heard her say it. She's no longer able to have a relationship with her mother and father, at least not right now. And this is the same thing that's happened to me. So, you know, these are the costs that we have to pay sometimes when we walk away from the faith that was part of our lives for, in my case, and in many cases of other people too. You know, you may have been in Christianity or some other religion virtually all your life, and now you've walked away. Where do you go from here? So that's what I'm here to help you do, and I'm glad to be bringing you people like Bethany and other experts who have been there, done that, and who are working through some of these issues. So I hope the conversation with Bethany was good. I'm glad that I'm able to bring you more people's life stories. These are real people. These are not people that are celebrities, superstars, or whatever. These are just normal people who are working through the issues, and they're sharing their stories with the listeners. So I'm hoping that, again, that it was a helpful episode. Hopefully now, in the next episode, we'll have either Dr. Yanya Lalage, or we'll have an episode with the How To Heretics, or something else will come up. I'm not entirely sure, but I'm not too worried about it because I'm meeting fantastic people all the time. I'm still working on getting Dr. Stephen Hassan of the book Combating Cult Mind Control. I've actually finished that book. He sent it to me. It's a fantastic book that I highly recommend. And I'm working on Dr. Lalich's book. Her book is called Take Back Your Life, which is also another excellent book. So I'm hoping to be bringing you one of those episodes coming up. I just want to mention too really quickly that if you're in the Pacific Northwest, we are doing an ex-evangelical gathering on the 6th of July in the South Center area at the Azteca restaurant. If you want to come out and meet some of the people that I've had the pleasure of meeting, Brian Staples will be there. He was on the podcast last year, and it's been good to have him come out as well. And so we're going to have some other people. We're also doing a live YouTube or podcast event on the 13th of July up in Canada with Neil 604, the Atheist from Canada. So stay tuned for that. More details are coming out. We're working on lining up a venue and figuring out who all is going to be there for this event with myself and Neil 604. So thanks for tuning in to this conversation with myself and Bethany Carter. Don't forget, if you want to be a supporter of this show on Patreon, the links for that are in the show notes. And if you're not able to do that right now, that's totally cool. I understand. What you can do for me is go on your favorite podcast platform, whether it's iTunes, Podbean, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you find this show, leave a 5-star rating, leave a review, and that will help me out as well with the show's visibility. All right, I'm going to let you go. Thank you once again for tuning in to hear my conversation between myself and Bethany Carter, as we talked about how this whole issue of spanking her children actually turned her into an atheist. I'll see you in a couple of weeks right here on Mindshift Podcast.